Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the Point series by China Forum. In this series, we will have one-on-one discussions with top-level officials, diplomats, well-known entrepreneurs, academics, and media experts from both China and abroad to hear their fresh insights on important global issues.
Hi everyone, this is Dong Ting coming to you from the CISS Tsinghua University, and you are listening to The Point. How does technology really shape global power? Today we are challenging some common assumptions about this question with Professor Jeffrey Ding from George Washington University. So drawing from his new book, Jeff offers a fresh perspective on how general-purpose technology spread across societies and transform international relations. From industrial revolutions to today's tech development, we will explore what his research reveals about the relationship between technological change and global power dynamics. So welcome and join us for the conversation. Well, I'm really excited about this conversation because not long ago, we hosted Professor Jeffrey Ding from George Washington University at our center for a book talk on his new work, Technology and the Rise of Great Powers, How Diffusion Shapes Economic Competition, published by the Princeton University Press. So the feedback was great. Everyone from IR scholars to tech policy folks, everyone really loved the fresh perspective in this new book. So today we are quite lucky to have Jeff with us again to continue the conversation and dig into some of the key ideas from his book. So Professor Ding, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Dong Ting. Really glad to talk with you today.
Thank you. And, you know, I was thinking about those conversations at the book talk. Well, many people, when they think about technological power today, they think about things like who is going to win the AI race, right? Or who's got the best quantum computers. But Jeff, your book tells quite a different story. So could you work us through your main argument first?
Yeah, so my book argues that technology shapes global power through a different pathway. And the technologies that matter most are general purpose technologies, like electricity or the steam engine, and potentially like AI. And for general purpose technologies, it matters less which country is the first to pioneer or develop frontier innovations, and it matters more which country is able to adopt and scale these technologies throughout their entire economy. And so in all of these past industrial revolutions, the countries that were able to meet the demands of what I call general purpose technology diffusion, the slow and gradual process by which a general purpose technology eventually spreads throughout all these different productive processes in the economy, the country that's best able to adapt to that process will be the most successful. And so my argument highlights the role of institutions that train and educate a broad pool of engineers, ordinary average engineers in a general purpose technology. And so that's the different pathway. And I think it goes against the conventional wisdom, which often focuses on which country is the first to pioneer new breakthroughs, which country has the best and brightest scientists, which country can protect its cutting edge research and development.
So, you know, that's really interesting because it makes me think about actually how we often focus on the wrong things or different things, right? It's not about who invents something first, but how widely it spreads, which makes me curious about how exactly you identify this GPT, general purpose technologies. So what made you focus on GPT diffusion rather than leading sectors? And particularly speaking, how do you differentiate between GPTs and the non-GPTs?
Yeah, this is a really important question. I think this concept of a general purpose technology is not new. It's something that I'm drawing on from the economics and economic history literature And so these scholars have identified GPTs by three specific characteristics. One is they have this scope for continual improvement. So there is always a broad research paradigm connected to this general purpose technology. It's a very foundational advance. Second is it has this potential for pervasive applicability. So it has the ability to acquire a wide variety and range of uses. And then the third is it has a lot of technological complementarities, which means it can only make its mark after all these different application sectors adapt to this technology. And so we can see how those three characteristics might fit AI as a potential GPT. But for other emerging technologies, even ones that we see as really important to technological leadership and that get a lot of attention in the headlines, they don't necessarily meet the characteristics of a GPT. So to give one contrasting example of a technology that might be more like a leading sector, which is a new fast-growing industry that oftentimes becomes one of the largest in the economy. In the past, we've had examples of leading sectors like cotton textiles, the steel industry, the automobile industry. And I think the key point there is for those industries, even though they're really significant, they don't have this wide range and variety of uses in that they're not enabling all these other sectors of the economy. So what's happening in the automobile industry, or say the electric vehicle industry today, is exciting, but it's not fundamentally transforming what's happening in the AI industry. Whereas all these advances that are happening in artificial intelligence are enabling so many different improvements in the electric vehicle industry. And so one technology is more foundational and more general purpose than the other. And so I think these nuanced distinctions between different types of technologies are really important because the optimal approach to fostering an electric vehicle industry might be very, very different from the optimal approach to fostering the adoption of AI across the entire economy. And so understanding these different technological trajectories is a necessary first step.
So the way you distinguish GPTs highlights something quite fundamental. It's not just about those exciting breakthroughs, but about broad-based capabilities. Actually, in your book, I love how you argue that ordinary engineers matter more than heroic inventors. So what do you make of this? Are we too obsessed with innovation? And why do we tend to celebrate breakthrough inventions over gradual improvements?
Yeah, I think this is a great thread. And I think we discussed this a little bit at the Book Talk event, and some of the audience members also brought up this point. I think there are two main reasons. The first is, I think there's almost these cultural biases towards this eureka moment where we celebrate the moment of invention. We celebrate that moment of initial innovation. And some of that is in media depictions and cultural depictions, we valorize the technologists, right? We really celebrate the Elon Musks of the world or the Jack Ma's of the world. And they dominate the headlines. And we accord a lot of status to these heroic inventors. And I think there's less status given to people behind the scenes who are doing that work of maintenance and adaptation and incremental improvements that are really necessary for a general purpose technology to eventually spread throughout all these different economic sectors. I think the second reason why we tend to celebrate these breakthrough innovations and when we assess different nations' technological capabilities, we focus on innovation capacity is because it is sometimes easier to measure. So we have a lot of measures of patents and high-profile, highly cited publications. It's much more difficult to measure the process by which technology is actually used and diffused throughout the economy. And it's harder to get those measures. And so if something can't be measured very well, then it sometimes doesn't get the attention that it deserves. So I think those would be the two main reasons. And I do think that there is this innovation centrism, this bias towards innovation that really permeates our analysis about competition over emerging technologies.
Interesting. We need something to mirror. We need a big name there, something tangible. So, having said that, when you talk about electricity spread through the economy or how AI might transform different sectors, you are mainly focusing on economic power. But there is another domain where actually innovation or technology is really, really crucial, right? The military. So could your framework help us understand how military innovation spread as well? The patterns, I mean, military and civilian, similar or different?
Yeah, it's a necessary distinction to make. I think the book is primarily focused on economic power, as you said. It's trying to ask, how do technological revolutions affect the rise and fall of great powers, with a focus on the first stage in the rise and fall of great powers, which is oftentimes relative economic decline or relative economic growth, or the ability of one country to sustain economic growth at higher rates than its rivals. So I take for granted that economic power is foundational to military power, and economic decline often precedes military decline. But I do think that this framework of general purpose technology diffusion can be helpful for us to better understand military power as well. So I've done some other research on this question of how general purpose technologies like electricity shaped the balance of military power. And what I found really interesting is, when electricity was a new technology back in the late 19th century, a lot of commentators and analysts thought that the main impact of electricity on military affairs would be this super weapon of sorts that would allow armies to shoot electric rays of mass destruction and sweep entire armies off the battlefield. But actually, the impact of electricity didn't come through this one narrow application, right? Electricity has all these different applications, not just in the civilian realm, but also in the military realm. And it wasn't just about controlling guns. It wasn't just about improving communications and intelligence gathering. It wasn't just about all these transportation applications. It was all of these and more, and included all of these back-end logistics processes. And so, in many ways, you can map on the same pattern of GPT diffusion to military effectiveness and how innovations shape military power. And in that research, one of my main findings was, because the trajectory of a GPT evolves so much faster and more intensively in the civilian realm, where there's always going to be a lot more applications, the crucial question for militaries as they try to adapt to GPTs is, can they tap into that pool of civilian talent and infrastructure and technology? And are there robust linkages between the military's efforts to electrify or to intelligentize its operations and what's going on in the civilian realm? In a nutshell, I do think there are some insights from this book that can travel from the civilian domain to the military domain as well.
The dual-use technology. So
Exactly.
this really hits home when we think about current US-China competition because everyone focused on winning in artificial intelligence. But based on your framework, maybe both of us, right, both our countries need to rethink our approach. So any policy adjustment would you suggest?
Yeah, I think both the US and China have oriented their technology strategy around this leading sector model, this view that technological leadership is grounded in which country can come up with the next frontier breakthroughs in all these different new technologies. And so I think before I dive into some of the specific policy proposals, I think the broad guideline from my point of view is shifting from an innovation-centric approach to AI development towards a more diffusion-centric approach to AI development. And so I think maybe I'll start with the US's end. I think a lot of the US's approach, including that of the Biden administration, has been building up this Fortress America to prevent cutting-edge AI breakthroughs from leaking to China. And that's just a really tough approach. That's tough in the sense of it's a very infeasible and difficult policy because GPT is so foundational. It's this entire research paradigm. Historically, you can't monopolize innovation in this space. And so I suggest that the US instead should adopt a run faster approach where it tries to invest in a range of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, education initiatives to broaden the base of average AI engineers. It can do a lot of policies like innovation voucher programs that incentivize small and medium-sized businesses to bring in ideas from frontier firms. So those are some of the specific policies I mentioned for the US side. On the China side, I'm less familiar with the specific policy environment. I think when I look at what China is doing in AI and all these other emerging technologies, I do think that China seems to be meeting a lot of its benchmarks and targets when it comes to investment in cutting-edge R&D. But China actually spends much less on education than some of these other newly industrializing countries. And so a lot of my book focuses on how do you broaden the pool of institutions that can train average AI talent, and that some of that can be boosted by investing in these centers of excellence that can do cutting edge R&D. But I think a lot more can be accomplished by trying to support a broader range of institutions and do better sort of average technical education. And so those are the different types of policy adjustments that I suggest in the book.
Thank you. That's very important. Education is the very fundamental factors and going to, affect a lot of these policies for a very long time. So actually, I teach science, tech, and international relations in our School of Social Sciences here in Tsinghua. So I'm truly excited that you have written this book because it takes a bold step away from usual ways our IR scholars approach power and technology in IR. So when you were developing all this theoretical framework, and it was not just about engaging with the existing IR series, you actually went back and re-examined how technology spreads through history, right? So, and I'm really curious actually about the whole process when you actually dug into this historical records of the three industrial revolutions. What surprised you the most?
It's cool to hear that you teach that course. I think I'm really excited about this growing subfield of science, technology, and international relations. So, really great to hear that you're also teaching in this space. I think for me, I don't know if there was this one discovery. I think part of it was everyone mentions these past industrial revolutions. And I just wanted to come up with my own read of these things. And I also was just really interested in reading technology history and economic history. It was really fun to read about machine tools in the 1840s and 1850s. And I think one person's work that was really influential for not just the historical case studies, but for the theory of the book was this historian of technology named Nathan Rosenberg. And he wrote this amazing article about how the machine tool industry became the center of transmitting all these different skills and techniques throughout the entire US economy. And I think what stuck out to me about that article, as I was digging through the historical records, was the machine tool industry is not one that's celebrated in all these traditional international relations texts or these big histories that we have of technological revolutions. It's never listed as a leading sector. It's never one of the largest or flashiest sectors of the economy. But there was some sort of fundamental process going on in that sector. It was connected to this whole process of interchangeable manufacture. And so that was a light bulb moment for me in terms of there was something missing from what political scientists and international relations scholars had understood about these past industrial revolutions and how they affected the rise and fall of great powers. And they were missing this process that Nathan Rosenberg captured with the machine tool industry. And then I began to see similar trends as I went through some of these other past industrial revolutions. So I think I'm really glad you asked this question. And I tried to emphasize this during my talk in the question and answer sessions. Like, this is not a book that's based on a lot of original primary source research from my end. It's really built on the great work that other scholars, especially historians of technology and economic historians, have already done and adapt insights from these other disciplines to show that we international relations scholars, political scientist scholars, have gotten some of the story wrong when it comes to these past technological revolutions.
Mm-hmm. Understood. So it's fascinating how this, all of these historical insights, these jobs have done by historians and economists that really challenge our current assumptions. But even with all this research, I think there are always gaps in our understanding. So my last question, from your perspective, for young scholars who want to explore these areas further, what research questions would you suggest they focus on?
There are so many. I think one of the shortcomings of the book is I could only dig so far down the causal chain. And so what I mean by that is my story ends with the key factor of institutions that can widen the base of engineering talent connected to a GPT. And so that's the factor for me that explains why some great powers or rising powers are able to take better advantage of industrial revolutions than competitors. But there's always the next question of, okay, so then why were those countries able to build these institutional ingredients to train a broad base of engineers in this GPT? And there's so many different factors that future research could explore. I'll just give an example of one of the threads that I just didn't have time and space to look further into, which is the role of gender in broadening the base of engineering talent in some of these past industrial revolutions. In the second industrial revolution case, so this is the 1870 to 1914 period, when the US was able to really broaden the base of mechanical engineering education. I saw some references that the US at that time was a pioneer in terms of co-education, where there was more gender inclusivity in terms of access to education. And I wasn't able to trace that story in these other industrial revolutions, but I think it's a really important strand when we talk about education and emerging technologies today, where in a lot of countries, including both the US and China, there is such a stark gender divide when it comes to who is getting educated in STEM fields and some of these emerging technologies. And so there's this open question of, does more inclusivity when it comes to gender divides and access to education, does that also have implications for whether a country is able to adapt better to a GPT? Like AI. And so I think that's one strand of future research that I think would be fascinating to explore. But I think the broader point there is going the next step and asking what accounts for why some countries were able to develop this GPT skill infrastructure and others weren't. I had to stop my story somewhere. And then I would say the other strand for future research is the book focuses on institutions that cultivate human capital. And I think that's really important because talent permeates all other types of institutions, and it's so foundational to being able to adapt to a new technology. But it's not the institutions for skill formation are not the only types of institutional factors that could facilitate and enable faster and more intensive GPT diffusion. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities to look at other types of institutional arrangements. And so you could look at intellectual property rights regimes. One of the things that I think is really crucial today are the institutional environment for open source software in both China and the US, and how that could facilitate better diffusion of AI across the entire economy. And so I think I could keep going for a long time, but I'll leave it there with those two broad buckets of opportunities for future research. I think there's a lot of ground that I wasn't able to cover, and hopefully other researchers and future scholars can pick up the torch there.
Thank you. Very interesting, the perspective of gender and why some countries better at adoption and adaption of new technologies. Those are very thought-provoking questions. So thank you. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you so much for this conversation. From rethinking how technologies shape power to challenging how we view U.S.-China competition, and you have such wonderful suggestions for our young scholars. I really enjoy hearing about your research and ideas, and I'm sure our listeners will too. So best of luck with the book. I hope it reaches a wide audience and generates many important discussions. And on that note, Happy New Year, and wishing you and your family a wonderful year ahead. And we look forward to more of your great work in the future. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Ding.
Thanks so much, Dongting. It was a joy to reconnect after meeting at the book talk, and looking forward to continuing dialogues and conversations in the future.
That was Professor Jeffrey Ding, offering us a new framework for understanding how technology shapes international relations. His insights on technological diffusion and its impact on global power challenge many, many of our conventional assumptions. So this is Dongting for The Point, a CIWS podcast. Catch you next episode.